Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Samavit Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai. Gaura Premananda. All glories to Simple Devotees. All glories to Simple Devotees. All glories to Simple Devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Granga. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Prasadabhade, Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Kamani Ramasi Sarasadhi, Gaura Bhani Bhattani, Yuvishesha Shunyavadi Paschitaya Desitarani. Okay, here's an update on Bhakti Churu Swami, just I guess from this morning. Dear devotees, Maharaj had a stable day. The medical team reviewed Maharaj's progress for the last 12 hours, and Maharaj's condition is improving. His blood pressure and heart rate are much better, and his temperature is normal. Today they stopped giving paralytics, and if the condition remains stable for the next 24 hours, the doctors will reduce the sedatives. As mentioned in the previous update, Maharaj has entered a very crucial period in his recovery process. We humbly request all devotees around the globe to keep intensity of their prayers high with intent. At this critical time, the prayers and our humble plea to Krishna and Srila Prabhupada. Our focus remains on the smiling face of Bhakti Churu Swami Maharaj coming out of the ICU. Next update in 12 hours, Hare Krishna from his medical team. Hare Bol. Well, that's at least a little bit of good news that there's some improvement. Okay. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 7, The Son of Drona Punished. We're reading text 15 through 18. So we'll just do 15, I guess responsibly, since we now have devotees in the temple room. Let's see. Matashishushnam niranam sutanam.
Matashishushnam niranam sutanam.
Nishamya goram paritapyamana.
Nishamya goram paritapyamana.
Tata rudad vasp. Tuta rudad vaspa kula kulakshi. Tam satyavan aha kiritamali. Mata shushunam nidavam sutanam. Nishamya goram paritapyamana. Tara rudad vaspa kalu kalaski. Say that one again. Tada rudad vaspa kala kulakshi. Tam satyavan aha kiritamali. Others.
Mali,
Namaste.
Ladies? Mata, the mother, Shishunam, of the children, Nidhanam, massacre, Sutanam, of the sons, Nishamya, after hearing, Goram, ghastly, Paritapyamana, lamenting, Tada, at that time, Arudat, began to cry. Vaspakala akula akshi. With tears in the eyes. Tam. Her. Satyavan. Pacifying. Aha. Said. Kiritamali. Arjuna. Translation. Draupadi, the mother of the five children of the Pandavas, after hearing of the massacre of her sons, began to cry in distress with eyes full of tears. Trying to pacify her in her great loss, Arjuna spoke to her thus. Translation, O gentle lady, when I present you with the head of that Brahmin, after beheading him with the arrows from my Gandiva bow, I shall then wipe the tears from your eyes and pacify you. Then, after burning your son's bodies, you can take your bath standing on his head. I'm going to skip the purport because that's the one I'm going to focus on today and then read the next two verses. I'll come back and read that purport. 17. Arjuna, who is guided by the infallible Lord as a friend and driver, thus satisfied the dear lady by such statements. Then he dressed in armor and armed himself with furious weapons, and getting into his chariot, he set out to follow Ashwatthama, the son of his martial teacher. 18. Ashwatthama, the murderer of the princes, seeing from a great distance Arjuna coming at him with great speed, fled in his chariot, panic-stricken, just to save his life, as Brahma fled in fear from Shiva. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. According to the reading matter, either Ka or Arka, there are two references in the Puranas. Ka means Brahma, who once became allured by his daughter and began to follow her, which infuriated Shiva, who attacked Brahma with his trident. Brahmaji fled in fear of his life. As far as Arka is concerned, there's a reference in the Vamana Purana. There was a demon by the name of Vijayanmali who was gifted with a glowing golden airplane which traveled to the back of the sun, and night disappeared because of the glowing effulgence of this plane. Thus the sun god became angry, and with his virulent rays he melted the plane. This enraged Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva then attacked the sun god, who fled away and fell down at Kashi, Varanasi, and the place became famous as Lolarka. Okay, it has a couple of interesting pastimes here, which I don't know too much about, and I checked in the purport by Vishwan Chakravarti Thakur, and he says exactly the same thing. And it's identical to Prabhupada's, so I have not a lot more further to add to those interesting purports. But to get back to our topic of the killing of the sons of Draupadi by Ashwatthama and Arjuna's response. I'm going to read the translation now, the purport to text 16. O gentle lady, when I present you with the head of that Brahmin, after beheading him with arrows from my Gandiva bow, I shall then wipe the tears from your eyes and pacify you. Then after burning your son's body, you can take your bath standing on his head. Strong words. Purport. An enemy who sets fire to the house, administers poison, attacks all of a sudden with deadly weapons, plunders wealth or usurps agricultural fields, or entices one's wife is called an aggressor. Such an aggressor, though he be a Brahmin or a so-called son of a Brahmin, has to be punished in all circumstances. When Arjuna promised to behead the aggressor named Ashwatthama, he knew well that Ashwatthama was the son of a Brahmin, Dronacharya, but because the so-called Brahmin acted like a butcher, he was taken as such. And there was no question of sin in killing such a Brahmin son who proved to be a villain. Om Gyanatimarandasha Gananjana Salakaya Chaksurani Tamina Tasma Shri Gurve Namaha Vanchakopa Tubhischa Kripa Sindhu Devacha Patitano Pavanibhyo Vaishnavi Namo Namaha Hare Krishna. So here we are reading about Ashwatthama's very, very heinous act, murdering the sleeping sons of the Pandavas. As you know, everyone had pretty much been killed. The war was over. There was no strategic reason whatsoever. It was just in a very spiteful way to eliminate all of the descendants of the Pandava brothers that Ashwatthama, in a very, very cowardly way, killed all of their sons while they were sleeping. Then, of course, I don't think it's mentioned later, but then, of course, he attempts to kill Maharaj Parikshit, who's in the womb of his mother Uttara. And, of course, Uttara was the wife of Abhimanyu, the son of Arjuna, so Parikshit would have been the last male descendant of the Pandava line. So Ashwatthama's intent was to completely wipe them out so that they could not continue. And of course, we all know how Maharaj Parikshit was saved in the womb by Lord Krishna himself. But we can see that in response to this, Arjuna, being a Kshatriya warrior, was fully prepared to kill Ashwatthama. Now, Arjuna's dramatic declaration here, you know, seems quite strong, but it's fully justified. This is a completely abominable act. You know, that who would do such a thing? I mean, the most low-class person, you know, not even, it's barely a human being to kill children sleeping like that. You know, so, and this, and he was supposedly a Brahmin. He was the son of Dronacharya, who was a Brahmin. Although Dronacharya acted in some ways as a Kshatriya, as a warrior, he was a Brahmin. He was a teacher of the military arts. So normally a Brahmin would not be punished. That was one of the rules of Vedic civilization. A Brahmin, you know, really should be respected as a person who exemplified religious principles and therefore would not be punished because they knew religious principles. In this case, it was different. The word is given in the verse here, Brahmabandha. Is that it? And Prabhupada calls Brahmabandha the son of a Brahmin, or in other words, someone who may appear like a Brahmin, but is not actually a qualified Brahmin. Let's see. So-called Brahmin. Yeah. So he was a so-called Brahmin. He was not a real Brahmin. Why? He was not qualified because a Brahmin must be qualified by his work and his character. Bhagavad Gita tells us that varnashram is established by guna and karma, by one's activity and by one's qualities. So the quality of a Brahmin has nothing to do with the activity that we see of Ashwatthama. The quality of a Brahmin is merciful, honest, truthful, compassionate, learned, all of these things. Brahmins are teachers and scholars and physicians and priests. They are not butchers, as Prabhupada described Ashwatthama here. And his activity was horrific, cowardly, and criminal. Therefore, Arjuna was fully justified in wanting to take the life of Ashwatthama, even though he was a Brahmin. Now, Prabhupada quotes here in the beginning of this purport, there are specific directions from the Vedas. I forget, it's in one, I forget which scripture it's from. It's not one of the real commonly known ones, but I saw a reference to it in another purport of Prabhupada's. But there are six aggressors who are eligible to be punished or killed, according to the Vedas. It's one, Prabhupada says, one who sets fire to the house, one who administers poison, one who attacks all of a sudden with deadly weapons, one who plunders one's wealth or usurps agricultural fields, or one who entices one's wife. Now, I've seen in other ways Prabhupada is defined as he says one who kidnaps one's wife. So I think it's a little stronger than just enticing. In other words, if one stole or kidnapped your wife, you know, obviously very, you know, something you would respond to very strongly. So all of these circumstances, they pose great threat to the life and the livelihood of any person. You might think, well, usurping an agricultural field? Well, think about an agrarian culture. If somebody stole all your crops, your agricultural field, or burned them down or something like this, what would that mean? It means your family would starve to death, right? Basically, yeah. You might get help from the king or something, but you would starve without this in this type of a more simple society and culture. So all of these circumstances are immediate threats to the life and the livelihood of a person or their family. So in those cases, are the Vedic literature say that one is fully justified in defending oneself, one's property, up to the point of even killing the other person. Now, I was thinking about this, that this concept isn't some strange, archaic thing from ancient Vedic culture. It's a common principle. It's a common principle, even in Western law. The right to protect one's life, one's home, is well established in law. In fact, there's something they call the castle doctrine. We don't have any lawyers here, but the castle doctrine is something that's well known, well established. Comes originally, I think, from English expression idea that one's home is one's castle, right? You ever heard that expression, one's home is one's castle? In other words, it's very dear to a person, just like a king's castle. A common person's home is just as important to them. So your home, your family, everything in it is to be protected. So now I'm going to quote from that famous scripture, Wikipedia. It says, the castle doctrine is also known as castle law or defensive habitation law, a legal doctrine that designates a person's abode or any legally occupied place, such as a vehicle or a home, as a place which that person has protections and immunities permitting one in certain circumstances to use force up to and including deadly force to defend oneself against an intruder. So it is commonly used in the United States, but also many other countries. This is something that has been somewhat controversial. The state we live in, Florida, is very strong in this idea of castle law and what they call the stand your ground laws. And some people feel they're too strong one way and others the other. But anyway, just basically, like for instance, in the state of Florida, they have a stand your ground law that was passed in 2005. The law allows those who feel a reasonable threat of death or bodily injury to meet force with force rather than retreat. Similarly, castle doctrine laws assert a person does not need to retreat if their home is attacked. It says over half the states in the United States have a similar kind of law. So my point here is simply that this is something that is well recognized in many, many laws throughout the United States and through other countries, throughout Europe, etc. In fact, I was looking at trying to figure out where this came from, and it's even referenced from Roman law. Goes back that far, and of course Roman law, Rome and Greece were probably influenced by Vedic culture, you know, by some migration over to them, not completely of course, but some aspects of it. So in other words, this is an ancient idea and a modern idea, that a person has a right to protect oneself, one's home, one's family. It's kind of natural actually. Most people, these things are easily understood. I was thinking about this, it had some, you know, kind of a personal meaning to me because I was going back many, many years when I was much younger, in the 60s during the Vietnam War. And, you know, most of us, at least all my friends, my circle of friends did not particularly want to go to Vietnam. We didn't really believe in it. We were all kind of on the left wing, radical side and doing protests and all of this. And so, you know, but I was, 1A, I was number 3 in the draft. I was about to get drafted for Vietnam. So I thought about, well, should I apply as a conscientious objector? That was something that you could take a particular position that you were a pacifist, that you didn't believe in war, and you could be exempted. So I had to think about that very carefully. And of course, the people would always, you know, questions to be asked. Hey, well, what would you do if your family were attacked? Would you be a pacifist? And I had to answer no. Actually, I couldn't ethically say I was a pacifist, so I didn't go that route. I got out of the war in Vietnam, and out of the army, but that's another story. Most of us feel like if we're in these kind of situations, one has to respond appropriately. And of course, most of you know I'm the head of the security here, so we strongly feel this. It's a great responsibility for those of us in that kind of position to defend the devotees and the deities and the temple, however necessary, up to one's own life. That's just sort of part of the code of being a leader or a kshatriya of any type. Not that anyone is much of a kshatriya or a brahmin or anything. We're all shudras in Kali Yuga. But to the point that we take on these services, one has to be very conscientious about them, about executing them, according to Shastra and according to the example of our acharyas and the great Vaishnavas in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So the Arjuna and the Pandava brothers were perfect examples of kshatriya kings. They were kshatriyas, of course, were guided by the Brahmins, and they were the leaders, the managers of society, like presidents and kings. They were also the warriors. It's not that they sent other people off to battle. They actually went to the front. They led the battle. They defended their country. They defended their people. They defended their subjects. So Arjuna, of course, is one of the greatest examples of a warrior. I think he was the greatest archer ever. Karna might have been, you know, in the mix between Karna and Arjuna. They were the absolute best. Yudhishthira, his older brother, was famous as a saintly king. He was a warrior too, but not as much. He was more known as a righteous leader. He was called Dharmaraj, one who was the king of Dharma, of religious principles. He knew what was right and wrong, and he would defend the principles of religion however it was necessary. So the role of kshatriyas is very, very important in the Vedic system. The Vedic system, of course, was a monarchy. It's explained by Srimad Bhagavatam 2:27-22 in Srila Prabhupada's purport. He says, the kshatriyas are the ruling ministers of any part of the universe, are factually the representatives of the almighty personality of Godhead, and they are meant to lead the subjects towards the path of God realization. Every state and its administrators, regardless of the nature of the administration, monarchy or democracy, oligarchy, dictatorship, autocracy, have the prime responsibility to lead the citizens toward God realization. We see a lot of that today, right? No. No. Regardless of the type of government, Prabhupada said, the main job of the leader is to help the members of society advance spiritually. This is essential for all human beings and is the duty of the father, the spiritual master, and ultimately the state to take up the responsibility of leading citizens towards this end. Now, of course, today many people object to the concept of monarchy. And monarchies have basically been torn down or put aside in many places of the world, and they don't exist as much as they used to. So the problem isn't really with the idea of a monarchy in itself, the problem is with the corruption of the monarchy. The monarchy system of Kali Yuga has become completely corrupt, and they are not doing as what is just was said in the previous purport about guiding the citizens towards God realization. Rather, they are more interested in, you know, their own interests. In Bhagavatam 4:12-10, Srila Prabhupada said, a king is not meant to realize taxes from the citizens and accumulate wealth to spend in sense gratification. World monarchy has failed ever since kings began to satisfy their personal senses with the taxes accumulated from the citizens. Of course, whether the system is monarchy or democracy, the same corruption is still going on. So that's really the problem. And Prabhupada says in Bhagavad Gita that in this age of Kali, monarchy decayed and has finally been abolished. So this is the situation. It's interesting about taxation. I was reading, I think it was in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita I was reading the other night, Actually, Sanatana Goswami was saying that the ruler or the monarch is allowed to take 1/6 of the citizen's wealth for taxes. And when you think about it, that's probably what most of us pay now in America. That's whatever that is, 15% or something. In other words, there's some normal taxation is there. But they also got 1/6 of the karmic reactions of the citizens. So in other words, yeah, you can receive their money for the maintenance of your government, but you are also going to be completely responsible for whatever they do. So you better lead your people in the right way. You have an absolute obligation to lead them in self-realization and God consciousness and performing dharma and performing religious duties. Otherwise, the king would suffer. So this is the problem. In Kali Yuga, most of the monarchs are corrupt, and thus there's been the rise of democracy or democratic ideas. Not that democracy has necessarily fared much better, and our rulers are not so much better, but most people think it's better to elect a corrupt ruler of one's own choice than one imposed upon you. So they choose their own corrupt rulers to, you know, simply take advantage. And now most monarchs that are still around are reduced to a ceremonial rule. The Queen of England, who is also the richest woman in England, so she does quite well in her position, but mainly she goes around and cuts ribbons and, you know, it's ceremonial. And people it's a sentiment that they like the idea of a queen and a king and, you know, they have them and, you know, it's sort of a sentimental idea of monarch and they have this sort of symbolic role representing the country, but they have no power. And that's really happening more and more because of this corruption and the downfall of monarchy. Now, how does this corruption happen? Well, first of all, they're in Kali Yuga, they're no Brahmins. They're no real qualified Brahmins, and no one is really teaching true religious principles, Vedic knowledge. So the concept of service to God being primarily your primary duty has been lost. And rulers no longer see themselves as servant. Any leader, any ruler must see themselves first as servant. I'm a servant of my guru, I'm a servant of the Lord, I'm a servant of my people. Just like Srila Prabhupada, sometimes he'd talk like this and he would say how his role, that he was actually servant to all his disciples. What was his service? His service was to teach us, to instruct us, to make us devotees. It was a service, he saw it as a service. He didn't say, I'm the master of all these disciples. No, my service to Krishna and to my disciples is to make them Krishna conscious. So this is the concept, and a leader must take the same role. So in the Vedic political system, it's really, people might think it's an autocracy, but it's really a meritocracy. Meritocracy means by merit. One is qualified to be in a position. And again, by guna and karma, by one's nature and by one's work or one's ability. And if one's not qualified, then they cannot be in that role. We have examples from thousands of years ago in the Srimad Bhagavatam. We had King Vena. King Vena was an unqualified ruler who plundered the citizens, who did not promote religious principles. In fact, he persecuted the Brahmins and stopped religious practice. What was the result? The Brahmins took him out. They basically, through mantra, killed King Vena. So, in other words, that's when Brahmins were very powerful. Unfortunately, we don't have any Brahmins that can do that these days. But, because everyone is a Sudra in Kali Yuga. The Brahmins are Sudra, the Kshatriyas are Sudra, we're all Sudras, or less than Sudra. Yeah. I mean, most of our habits put us way below the Sudra category into some other, you know, Muleccha type of category. So thus we have incompetent rulers. And this is not something to be surprised by. It wasn't that long ago, a couple of months ago, we were reading the 12th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam during our Bhagavatam class, and we had these vivid, was it chapter 3? You remember, Brian, that where all the examples are given of the rulers, and I think it's chapter 3 of the 12th canto, it talks about in Kali Yuga, how the rulers will all be corrupt, and there's some more in chapter 1. But anyway, they, you know, these vivid descriptions that just seem absolutely true today. It's not like, oh, really, is that going to happen in the future? No, we see it today. You know, in other words, that, you know, that people are unqualified, that the rulers are only interested in their own sense gratification, their own wealth, their own power, you know, and just exhibiting power over others by any means possible, will lie, will cheat, will do anything. So no surprise that this is what we have in Kali Yuga. It's all predicted. and the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is now coming to pass. So the point is that those who are in authority, whoever one is, any leader in any situation, has a great duty of care for those in their charge, both for the material needs that they are taken care of properly. In other words, in the Vedic society, no one should even go hungry, you know, in a king's kingdom, where he ruled. What to speak of the spiritual needs? We have so many, of course, great examples, like Lord Rama. Lord Ramachandra was the perfect king. It's described in how no one suffered within his kingdom. This is from the Bhagavatam 9.10.53. When Lord Ramachandra, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was the king of this world, all bodily and mental suffering, disease, old age, bereavement, lamentation, distress, fear, and fatigue were completely absent. There was no coronavirus. Can you imagine this? There was no death for those who did not want it. Wow. Pretty amazing. I mean, of course, this is Lord Ramachandra, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But it's called Ramraj. And that's a very popular idea of Ramraj, the perfect ruler, who was like Lord Ramachandra. It's a king who cared for the citizens like a father. Now, after the demise of King Vena, what did the Brahmins do? They churned his body and created Prithu Maharaj, right? King Prithu was the opposite. King Prithu was a fully qualified, perfect king. He's also considered, I think, a Shaktivesh avatar of Lord Krishna. He's a great empowered incarnation, empowered representation of the Supreme Lord. And the Bhagavatam 4.16.7 says, this King Prithu will be very, very kind to all citizens. Even though a poor person may trample over the king's head by violating the rules and regulations, the king, out of his causeless mercy, will be forgetful and forgiving. As a protector of the world, he will be as tolerant as the earth himself. And of course, I'm thinking about Arjuna, who we're reading about today. He was not just a warrior, but he also had the same idea of kindness and compassion for his citizens. And when the Brahmin went to him and said that his sons had all died, he took personal responsibility for some Brahmin in his community, which he probably had nothing to do with. Didn't know the circumstances at all, but because his sons died, what did he do? He went to Yamaraj and brings them back. Takes that kind of responsibility for the personal lives of all the citizens. Of course, no one can do that. We can't expect that of leaders today. At least we can expect a little concern, a little protection, a little compassion for the lives of all the people that they are rulers over, and try their best to maintain material and spiritual happiness wherever they can. So the lesson of the Bhagavatam, and I had a lot more here, but we're out of time. The lesson of the Bhagavatam is not just for kings and rulers. Otherwise, okay, that's an interesting theory. What does it mean to us? I would contend that we are all leaders. We are all leaders in our own lives. Certainly, devotees are all leaders. You may be a temple leader, you may be a manager, you may be a parent. If you're a parent, you're a leader of your family, of your children. Who are your children learning from? Where are they getting spiritual lessons from? My experience working in Gurukul is for many, many years, and I think every teacher would agree with me that there's no greater influence than the influence of the parent. And we found that the children usually did well when their parents were doing well. When the parents had difficulty, the children had difficulty. So parents are leaders of their family and responsible. Of course, Lord Shabadeva says you should not become a mother, a father, a teacher, a guru, a king, unless you are prepared to relieve your dependent from the cycle of birth and death. So, pretty heavy responsibility. Anyone who has spiritual knowledge, which means all devotees, doesn't matter whether you're a temple president or whether you're a parent or whether you're a teacher or whatever you are, if you're a devotee of the Lord, you are a leader. Because Prabhupada wants us all to be Brahmins, or at least act like Brahmins, and that we are teachers. We have spiritual knowledge. If we have spiritual knowledge, we have responsibility to share that spiritual knowledge. So in that sense, we become leaders to the rest of society. So Leadership is something that often is thought about in terms of managing others. But the way the Bhagavatam looks at leadership is more pointed. It's another type of leadership that's talked about. Actually, there's an author named Robert Greenleaf. He articulated this concept called servant leader. It's commonly used, but he was the one person who sort of really developed this theory. And the idea of a servant leadership is really the model, is the Vedic model. It's the Vedic model that the leader is one who serves those under him, or under her, however it may be. And devotees can be in this role. I took this from this boy named Akura. He's a European, and he's like does coaching and consulting, and he did a lot of work with this idea of servant leadership, and he sort of Krishnaized it, you know, for devotees. This is something, I'm taking this from something he wrote, which I liked. He said, servant leaders are devotees who have taken up responsibility to personally take care of a group of serious candidates for advancement devotional service. They are leader servants. The concept is becoming more and more prominent in business sector today. They are facilitators. They recognize talent and potential devotees and help them express and engage them. They are friendly and unselfish. They like to see others advance. They like to assist others in becoming servant leaders. So I think we could all fit into that category. We could all see ourselves in those roles of helping others. Helping others in their lives in so many ways, of course, in their spiritual lives. And while we may not be great rulers and kings like Arjuna and the Pandavas, in our own very small, humble way, you know, we can look at those qualities and try to learn from them. Learn from the Vedic concept of what real leadership is, about giving spiritual life to those under us or over us or around us or whatever the situation may be. So, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Are there any questions or comments?
It's too long. Maybe you can read
better. Something else you have a class?
Bottom.
It says, I sent the following question from Tom Arbaru. Okay. Tom Arbaru, excellent class. Well, thank you. Comment on the six aggressors eligible to be killed. You mentioned your stand, your ground law, and the castle laws in recognize USA and elsewhere, recognizing that certain aggressors are eligible for death. However, killing a person entices or kidnaps one wife is not. That's probably true. One devotee that shot another devotee took his wife, perhaps based on his principles, has spent many years in jail for doing so. But it seems devotees should understand that they cannot take these principles in their own hands unless it's allowed by local law. Your common sense regard. Yes, you're correct. I think the others might be all acknowledged by law, but somebody who simply entices your wife is not grounds for killing them in most jurisdictions of law. So do not do that. And he's right. This person's been around a while, but those of us who've been around know there was a situation. Somebody, a devotee, did run off with another devotee's wife, and that devotee shot the devotee, and probably did not approve of it. He wasn't very happy about it. And this person spent about 8 years in jail, as I remember. He's out now. He's still a devotee. He's doing okay, last I saw him. But anyway, yeah, okay, point being made. But I think the greater point there is, and also, Prabhupada also defines that other place as one who kidnaps one's wife. So I think that would be a different situation, a little more severe. Okay.
One more. Mm-hmm. Our children are not only product of their parents' instruction or environment, but also carry karma from previous lives.
Yes. Yeah. I think our responsibility, as in all things, our responsibility is in the endeavor. Our responsibility is in what we do. We do our best, we make our attempts, we make the most Krishna conscious decisions we can. And as the Bhagavad Gita says, we may have our work, we have a right to our work, but not to the results, right? In other words, the results are not ours, it's up to Krishna. And we all know, and we've all experienced, sometimes despite the most Krishna-conscious parent, the child decides not to be Krishna-conscious. I've also seen situations where the parents are not so Krishna-conscious and the child is a wonderful devotee. So yeah, it's not like 100%. But I think my point still is valid, that parents do have a great role in children's lives, and they are very responsible for their lives and how they develop. They're not 100%, obviously. There are other factors that are there. And the question the person mentioned was one's past karma, one's past activities, what propensities one brings into this world. Certainly that's there. All right. Okay? Is that
There's
it?
More.
One more, okay. So people actually listen to these classes at home.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, it looks like they do. Okay, this is Srila Prabhupada's position on the use of violence appears to be complex. In politics, unless there's violence, you cannot take. Simply by sweet words, not possible. That was the difference between our political leaders, Mahatma Gandhi and Subhash Chandra Bose. So Subhash Chandra Bose was opinion that, and that is a fact, you are agitating nonviolence, these people will never care for your nonviolence. Unless there is violence, the Britishers will never go away. So Gandhi would say, no, I'm not going to accept this violence in Syria, I shall continue. That's it?
Yeah.
I don't know quite what the question or statement is. Yeah, well. Of course, we could say probably, ultimately, Gandhi prevailed. Right? Gandhi did prevail through his nonviolence movement. But it's interesting because there was a lot of violent response by the British, and I think the British lost world public opinion often because of that, and of course lost completely any loyalty probably of the Indian population. In other words, yeah, that was a situation where you had such a mass movement by such a strong, you know, powerful, charismatic leader that he was able to accomplish something not through violence. Yeah. I never said the only way you can change politics is through violence. That wasn't the point of this class. I don't know quite why that came up. Go ahead, Eleanor Codicy.
Just a comment about that, the comment about the children with their karma. And yeah, and that is true, of course. They do come with their own karma. But also, I believe that we attract certain souls to us,
yes,
as well. And that's the purpose of the Garbhadhan Samskara, because we're,
yeah,
you know, the purification, yeah, begins even way before. So we still have the responsibility.
Yeah, excellent point. In other words, a very responsible householders, they try to attract great souls to the Garbhadhan Samskara, and we see that's often the case. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into analyzing the circumstances at different people's births, but you know, we know that's a philosophical point. It's correct. Thank you. Okay, I'll go to Srila Prabhupada.
Mother Nandini Keshuri, confirming your comments from Srila Prabhupada's quote, Indian independence was achieved not by Gandhi's non-violence method, but by Subhash Bose's violence method. And he wanted to explain non-violence from Bhagavad Gita. Thank you for your informative class. We appreciate your service. We are listening attentively.